Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to Tax Tuesday. We're doing it in a little bit different format. We've been in a room with a lot of great people and a lot of folks that were streaming online doing the TaxWise workshop over the last 2 days. Hopefully you guys have been having some fun. Yes, having some fun?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's taxes don't have to suck. So we're just doing the Tax Tuesday live because, heck, it was scheduled at the same time and I didn't want to kick it. And I thought it'd be fun to kind of go through these. And plus, because these guys have gone through a 2-day intensive workshop, I want to see how many questions they can answer. So this is actually a quiz, and if you lose, bad things happen. All right, we're just going to jump through. All right, so first off, freebies, if you want to continue to educate yourself, you can always do so free on Facebook and on YouTube. Anderson likes to post lots of content. We just recently started Coffee with Carl, which Carl Zellner, one of our attorneys, likes to put these little 5-minute vignettes, which are fantastic, very well received. A bunch of you guys are nodding your head. It's been really awesome. Now, normally when we're doing the go-to meeting or the go-to webinar, I'm answering all the questions and I'm sitting there looking at this, asking you guys questions, and I can see the response. Today, I'm not going to be able to, so I have Elliot, wonderful Elliot, one of our attorneys and soon-to-be CPA, sitting here, and he's going to ask your questions as you ask questions or as you type them in. In this room, you guys can feel free to ask questions, too. The whole idea is that this is a sharing experience, and we like, I always call it giving drive-by wisdom to the masses. That's an old radio show that I heard, but it's drive-by tax wisdom to the masses. So ask your questions live. We'll answer before it's over, to the very best of our ability. Sometimes we get slaughtered. And if you have questions, this goes for everybody in the room too. You can always ask a question and you send it to Tax Tuesday to Anderson Advisors. And it can be as whatever tax question you want. If it's too specific, we're probably going to take it and kick it over to an accountant to actually give you a specific answer. Otherwise, I'm going to either make it part of this or you're just going to respond. And when I say that we get hundreds of questions, we quite literally, I could show you pages that are going into the $700 and $800 line items on questions that we get. And Elliot's about to learn. Are you on the go-to webinar chat or are you on a regular chat?
Yeah.
Just the regular chat here? It's not the go-to webinar, right? Yeah, because we will literally get, I think about on average, about 200 questions.
And he answers every one of them.
Not everyone. I usually miss a couple. I try to answer, but before 4 o'clock, right?
Right. Yeah, right.
So again, it's fast, fun, educational, a lot of fun, right? So let's go opening questions. Hopefully I can actually read these. If you have an S-Corp, do you have to take an annual salary or can you put the profits back in the company? Don't you guys answer. We're going to go through these because you guys already know this. I'm 75 years old with considerable medical expenses. I operate my businesses with an S-Corp. Did you write this? What do I have to do to take advantage of the reimbursement tax treatment? Sorry. We don't own HUD Section 8 buildings, but we do rent to Section 8 tenants, apartments and single family homes. For example, in one of our 4-unit apartments, 3 of the 4 units are Section 8. We listen to your HUD section and would like to know, are there any tax benefits that we can take advantage of? So we'll go over that as well. I have a corporation that I have, but it does not earn income. Do I still need to file a tax return? And if so, by what date? I'm buying a commercial building via limited partnership. The tenant is going to perform a large tenant improvement on the building once we sign the lease and close the deal. So the tenant's going to do that. If I do cost segregation on the building, as is right before the tenant does the improvement, can I then do another cost segregation on their tenant improvement portion of, on the next year? This is a triple net lease and the tenant is a third party. Interesting question. We'll answer that one. I have a C Corp and purchase a fixer flip. After renovation, I'm unable to sell the property. If I refinance it and pay a business credit card off as part of the refinancing, can I transfer it to a holding LLC as a personal rental? What, if any, would be the tax liability and how do I make sure it's done legally? On a newly purchased rental property owned by an LLC, performing the cost segregation study will create a large depreciation for the first year. How is this loss recorded on the income taxes? You guys seeing that? You guys, first off, you guys have heard a lot of these, right? Yeah, I'm going to ask you guys. If I am self-employed and own a small business, are the health insurance premiums tax deductible? What is the difference between a solo 401k, QRP, and cash balance pensions? Also, if my portfolio is just passive income and I only take cash distributions, is there a workaround it to establish a 401k? How do I sell a husband and wife C-Corp to reduce taxes? How is a series LLC and operating LLC reported on personal tax return? How do you determine the comparable square footage used for the meeting room when soliciting rental costs for the 280A 14-day rule? I expect to receive $35,000 to $45,000 capital gains from real estate soon. If I want to keep my AGI down, and I'm thinking about investing in an opportunity zone deal that has a minimum investment of $50,000, I will need to sell some stock to have the gain that will make up the difference. Can I mix the two types of gain for a single investment? What documents will I need to make sure that I properly document the transaction for current and future tax returns? Good question, by the way. I own an online business and I'm out of the country most of the year. Can I qualify for the foreign earned income exclusion? Is there a strategy where I can still contribute to my IRA or 401k? Interesting. Hope you know the answer to that one.
Elliot.
I have three kids. Can I pay them a modeling fee for multiple companies that I own for modeling? For example, if I have five companies, can all three kids be paid modeling fees from all five companies if they were truly models for that company and if it was customary in the business? If I have multiple companies and would like to have board meetings or meetings for the companies for 14 days, can I rent out a room and then pay each company the market equivalent of 14 days rental income for the exact 14 days? Not sure I follow that one, but we'll go over that. If I want to reimburse myself on a per diem basis for corporate travel rather than using expense reimbursement, how do I go about it? Can I figure out the per diem amount for each trip on the IRS website, but there is no form? What documentation is required for per diem reimbursement? I have 8 units in my own name. Will I save on taxes this year if I transfer them under my LLC? I recently retired from my job and had a direct rollover into a traditional IRA from a self-directed account in buying real estate properties to a self-directed account and buying real. Must be they're buying it in that new self-directed. Is it better to convert the account now to a Roth IRA for tax purposes since I'm anticipating expanding my real estate venture in the future, which will benefit me more in the terms of taxes when I sell the properties? Interesting. And then the last questions we're going to have is, I have my personal home and rural land in my personal name. I want to be able to isolate it from future ventures as well as be able to pass it over to my sons when the time comes. I lived in Colorado and have an LLC that was established a year ago without any holdings. It is registered here in Colorado. Do I use this existing LLC on the ranch or go with the trust and use the LLC for a future real estate move? So those are the questions. Is that a few questions? Yeah. It's called biting off a big chunk. All right. So here's the question. If you have an S-Corp, do you have to take an annual salary or can you put all the profits back in the company? Does anybody know the answer in this room?
Yes.
All right, so what's the answer?
Only take a distribution.
You don't, do you have to take a reasonable salary?
No.
You only have to take a reasonable salary if you take money out. If you don't take money out and you're just going to leave it in the S-Corp, you do not have to take a salary.
And you also don't have to take a salary if you did not make a profit.
If you did not take a profit. Yeah, so it looks like, hey, I just want to keep all the profits. So they said profits.
Yeah.
So we're just going to say, hey, maybe we're reading too much into it, but you guys nail it. You guys are smart. Good job. All right, I'm 75 years old with considerable medical expenses. I operate my business as an S-Corp. What do I have to do to take care of the reimbursement tax treatment? What are you guys thinking here?
Create a
C-Corp. Can I convert an S and change it to a C-Corp? All right, so do you want to go over the rule? I don't want to hold Bart.
No, you're doing fine. If you have an S corporation, you can revoke that S election and become a corporation. So anytime you revoke that S election, it doesn't matter how you form, you're going to be a corporation in IRS's view. The problem with that is you can only elect out of that S election. Elect out of the S election?
Mm-hmm.
You can only revoke that S election as of now. You can't go backwards. You can't say, I want to go back to January 1st of this year. And for all of 19, I want to be a C corporation. It doesn't work like that.
Mm-hmm. So to this guy out there, the deal is if you're reimbursing medical expenses out of your S corp and you need to be able to write them off, you're not able to write them off someplace else. So sometimes you're so far in excess of your adjusted gross income. So this would be a question. What's your adjusted gross income? because if it's if the rule is I can write off on my Schedule A more than 10%, then I need to know what that number is. So if you're making $20,000 a year, you have considerable expenses, and it's $2,000 that would be the amount that I can't write off, then I'm probably going to try to write it off individually. If I'm making money and I have significant adjusted gross income, then I'm probably going to be converting this over to a C, because that S corp, if it reimburses a greater than 2% shareholder, that's included in their income. If it's a C corp, it can enter into what you guys know what the plan is? You guys remember? 105 plan? And it can reimburse 100% of the medical expense. So it gets kind of fun. You guys see how this stuff works? It's not rocket science. It's just kind of knowing. We don't own HUD Section 8 buildings, but we do rent to Section 8 tenants. It's kind of weird. How do you know they're Section 8 tenants, right? Apartments and single family homes. So maybe you're not qualified as the Section 8 homeowner. Some of you guys have Section 8 in here. A few of you guys. So you actually have to go through the process. So maybe you're renting to those people. I do not know how they're renting to Section 8 tenants, because they would be getting a voucher. So if you're getting paid, so maybe they're just saying generally they're about the equivalent of a Section 8. For example, in one of our four-unit apartments, three of the four units are Section 8 tenants. We listened. This is what's weird. I think that they probably, yes, it's kind of weird. We listened to your HUD section and would like to know, is there any tax benefit that we can take advantage of?
Well, I think the first thing is when they say they're not a Section 8 housing building is they did not, the property was not built and designated as
Section 8.
Section 8, which would qualify them to get that low income housing credit.
Yeah, you're probably right. So they're probably going through and they've gone through the paperwork of qualifying it as a HUD.
So if you're going to rent out to Section 8, people who are qualified for Section 8, you have to be approved by HUD for their sleeping area, where they're going to be, their share of it. And there are no tax benefits other than that credit that we just talked about briefly for actually building low-income housing.
Yep. I will say this, though. If you are leasing to HUD folks, then that actually qualifies as a nonprofit activity. And if you wanted to transfer the house and take the deduction now and get the fair market value deduction if you've owned it over a year, or the basis if it's less than a year, and you want to do that now, you could actually create a nonprofit, and you literally have a nonprofit activity that you could run per infinity if you just kept those homes. The good side to that is, hey, I'm not worried about the income. I'm not worried about, I get a huge tax deduction. The bad side is, what if I get a bunch of money in that nonprofit? But remember, that nonprofit can enter into an accountable plan with you and reimburse you, and you could be receiving your money back out tax-free, non-reported.
The other upside to Section 8 housing or renting to Section 8 eligible people is who's paying their rent, or at least a portion of it? The government is. So at least some part of your rent income is guaranteed.
Mm-hmm. I actually like Section 8 tenants. Some people have bad stories, but I have always liked them. And here in the Valley, we have a couple, and other places we have them. I like it because it forces you to have somebody go out and inspect your house every year. Because not that I don't trust property managers, but I don't trust property managers. So I like the idea that somebody's looking at it going, hey, you need to fix this. I'm like, oh, okay, I'll fix that. Hey, property manager, why the hell didn't you tell me to fix that? You know, so anyway, so I kind of like that. And I like buying them from other people. You have a question?
We have a question. Hello, I'm partnering on a house flip, and I need to pay out 50% of our profits to my partner on this deal. What is the best way to handle? We'll just skip. What is the best way to handle that prior to our or during our sale, so I do not have to pay tax?
Jeez, Elliot.
And we just talked about that recently.
Yeah. So here's what it is. So somebody's flipping a house, and it sounds, do they have a partner, or is it they have a lender?
It says they are partnering, so I'm assuming it's partnering.
Then if they flipped a house with a partnership, then the profits are going to be allocated via K-1 to each partner in proportion to their interest. They will not be paying tax on their partner's income. If this was one of those funky doodle JV weird things where it's your property and they're kind of throwing in the money, and then it's really a participating loan, they're not actually an equity owner, then you pay them their 50% as interest, and you would deduct it as interest.
Have you seen anybody get in trouble with usury laws doing that?
Not on commercial. So when the only time you get into usury laws is when it's a residential property that you're lending on. If you are, and this is what's called a participation loan agreement. I actually prefer this for those of you guys. Anybody here flip? Anybody? A few of you guys? Do you guys ever use money from somebody else to do the flip? Always. All right. So some people will do a joint venture where you actually have a partner. Well, you owe them a fiduciary duty, and they can sue you for sneezing wrong. You know, hey, you passed up on this deal. Hey, you could have done this better, whatever else. I prefer lenders, and this is just me personally. I would do a participating loan, and I would say, you can loan me money, and I'll pay you a guaranteed rate of 4% or 50% of the net profit, whichever is greater. And that's called a contingent interest agreement. I call them participating loans. They work out just great, and that way when you close, they're getting an interest rate, and it lowers the profit by that amount, but you don't owe them a fiduciary responsibility. You can do what you deem is best, and you already have an interest rate that you can pay them. So if all hell breaks loose and you need to wait 2 years to sell that thing, you know how much you're paying them. Does that make sense?
And here's the problem I'm seeing with a lot of clients as they're getting into these. They're either getting hard money loans or doing these JVs, and they're not documenting what they're doing. They're not documenting how the money is to be, what it is you're actually receiving and what you're doing in return. Also, they're not always documenting in a JV situation or even a tenant in common situation, who's responsible for what.
We've seen a lot of really bad situations where you had folks doing gap lenders. They had 6 or 7 gap lenders all in first position. You know, they just never filed anything. They never filed anything on the properties. And they really, all they're doing is just ripping people off. So You just got to be careful whenever you're out there. I prefer to have a lender where they're secured, and I don't necessarily want a partner. So partners, to me, that's marriage. And unless I'm going to keep complete control of that situation, I don't want it, because it's easy to get into marriage and it's really expensive to get out. And so if you get into partnership with somebody that you just met or that you don't know real well, you got to make sure you have an exit before you walk in. And so I would be like, hey, you're in control. You're the manager. You're all sorts of fun stuff. Like you have control of this project, even if you have somebody else that's in there. Or if I'm the lender and I'm dealing with somebody that I don't know real well, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to make sure that the lender has the control and that other party has to prove that they can get it done before they get paid. And that way you can boot them if they don't come through.
Yeah, if you're that gap lender, you got to have that deed in trust or some type of security in that property, because we see quite a few hard money lenders lose their money because they have no security in the property.
Yep. All right. I have a corporation that I have, but it does not earn income. Sounds like Amazon. No, it has income. It just has losses.
Tesla.
What is it?
Tesla.
Oh, come on. You still need to file a return, and if so, by what date?
So if you have a corporation or S corporation, you are required to file a return every year you're in existence. Doesn't matter if you formed your corporation and never thought about it again, you're still obligated to file that tax return. Now, the upside on a C corporation is if you file it 10 years later, finally, and there's no income, you're not going to have any penalties. You're just going to have IRS nagging you.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an S corporation and you haven't filed a return or you file it late, it gets very expensive.
Mm-hmm. I guess because it's like $195
per partner per month.
We had one of those. It wasn't an S, it was a partnership. Were you here for that oil and gas guy?
Mm-mm.
Big oil and gas, about 450 partners, and they didn't file their partnership return for 2 years. The penalty was $1.38 million. Yeah, it was ridiculous. And they brought it over to us saying, hey, can you do anything? So we did the stupid thing of saying, sure, let's see what we can do. So we got a power of attorney and we wrote a letter and explained the situation. And they wiped out. They said, oh, okay, zero. And they reduced the liability down to zero. We didn't expect that. We were like, they'll probably get it down to a couple hundred thousand or something like that. So they waived it. But we never got a retainer. So they never paid us. Yeah, we literally wiped out almost a $1.4 million tax liability for nothing. We could sue them, but just, you know what? Lawsuits suck. I don't care if you ever sued anybody, how many people have sued somebody? Was it so much fun? No, you wake up every night at about 3 a.m. and you're like, you're Perry Mason and you're going to do all sorts of horrible things. You start thinking about hiring hitmen and all this stuff. Yeah, you're going to show up at their house. You're going to put poop underneath their door handle, all that fun stuff. Not that I've ever thought about that. What's the... you go to open the car door. I'm just... It'd be kind of gross. Just saying, that'd be kind of gross. Go ahead.
My wife stays at home, and we want her to become a real estate professional. What exactly does she need to do?
All right, class can answer that. What do you guys think?
$750. There's two tests.
One spouse has to hit 750 hours, and there's a little laundry list. It's the development, redevelopment, construction, management. Yeah, there's all sorts of things in real estate, 750 hours. And it has to be more than 50% of her personal time. And then the spouses together have to materially participate on their real estate, and you should group those activities, all your real estate together. And material participation is a slight, there's about 9 different tests, but the big ones are if you self-manage, you don't have to worry about how many hours. If you have somebody else manage, you have to hit 100 hours and be more than any individual that manages your property. And if you just don't want to care about it, you have to do 500 hours on your your project. Was there another part of that?
Yeah, if we employ her 760 hours in the management LLC, which I think they mean C-Corp, does that cover it?
You don't actually have to employ her. It just has to be 750 hours. It doesn't have to be employment. So you don't have to have the C-Corp actually employ. She just has to document the 750 hours. You guys already knew that, right?
Yeah.
Hey, you guys are getting it. You know that the tax court screwed that up? The tax court did not. Yeah, the first thing. Stop that. First time the tax court did it, they did a 750 hours and they were applying it to each property. They didn't understand there was two tests and that there were two distinct tests. So the 750 hours is one spouse. The material participation is a combination of the spouses. It's kind of fun. So apparently the court can't read code, but it was probably some lawyer that briefed it, and they briefed it wrong, and the court accepted the wrong briefing. All right. You want to read this one? Because
I'm buying a commercial business via a limited partnership. The tenant is going to perform a large tenant improvement on the building once we sign the lease and close on the deal. If I do cause segregation on the building as is right before the tenant does the improvement, can I then do another cost segregation on their tenant improvements? Sorry, I got new glasses. Improvement portion the next year. This is a triple net lease. I thought NNM was nah. Lease, and the tenant is a third party.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the problem with this, is that second sentence, the tenant is going to perform a large tenant improvement. So who owns that improvement? The tenant owns the improvement. So the tenant can cost seg the heck out of it and take the deduction on their return. But until the tenant actually abandons it, you don't own that improvement.
So it, when you have a triple net lease, that usually means that you're putting everything onto the tenant. And so the tenant actually owns all the improvements and everything else that they're doing. If you have an agreement that you own the improvements from the tenant, and I've actually seen that in leases.
Mm-hmm.
Where if they put improvements and it's affixed to the interior, then it's the landlord's, then that would be the case, but they have no cost basis in it.
Right.
So even if you could, you didn't pay anything for it. But if you paid for it and then, you know, like you gave the tenant, like here's the example. If you said, hey, Toby, I want to lease this piece of this building, and I say, okay, great, I'm going to do a tenant improvement for you, and I include the TIs, now I'm the one who paid for it, and then if I'm the landlord, then I'm going to probably go ahead and I can do the cost seg. That does not sound like it's the case here. It's the tenant is doing a large tenant improvement, but if the landlord is for some reason paying for it, then absolutely they could do it. The problem with the cost seg is you're going to do the cost segregation once, but then you're going to add when you actually do improvements to the 5, 7, and 15-year property, depending on what the contractors did. So the contractor should be breaking that down for you. Make sense? You guys are getting this stuff.
Are you looking to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and grow your wealth? Are you a real estate investor, stock trader, or business owner? If you answered yes, Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection Workshop is for you. Let host Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman teach you how to protect and keep more of what you earn. Our workshops are held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. 2 in-person tickets to the workshop are only $99. To learn more about the dates and locations, visit AndersonAP.com and register today.
All right. Any questions from the world of the internet?
Would a real estate marketing photography business count as real estate professional activity?
I honestly would say, my instincts say, on the 750, it might work. On the material participation, I do not think it would. So if I'm working, and realistically, it's on the buying and selling of real estate. So my gut tells me no. But I'd have to look it up.
Anyway. Yeah, I don't know. I think IRS would deem that it is more in the photography, the arts business, than it is in the real estate business.
Yeah, I think you're not going to have a success on that one. But we could take a look at it. There was somebody else that talked. I believe that there's a court case on lending. I would have to see if there's anything else. But there's two sides to this. There's any business that's in the acquisition and sales And then there's what I do on my actual properties. So if you're in a, even if it's a real estate company and you're just doing the flyby, you'd have to show that that's somehow you're integral in the part of the purchase and sale of the properties and you're not just doing photography and marketing. I think you probably lose that. All right.
On a newly purchased rental property owned by an LLC, performing the cost segregation study will create a large depreciation for the first year. How is this loss recorded on the income taxes?
So I create a big fat loss on my real estate activity. How is that loss? What is the default rule?
30%.
What kind of loss is it? Is it active or passive?
Passive.
It's considered a passive loss. And so can I write off passive losses against active ordinary income? No, so I would, that would be a PAL. It'd be a loss carry forward unless real estate professional. There you go. So the cost segregation is awesome. You won't lose it. It'll carry forward and offset your passive gains. So if I am making $30,000 a year on my rentals net, and I have and I buy a newly purchased rental property, and I get a $100,000 deduction on it, it'll offset that $30,000 in year one, $30,000 in year two, $30,000 in year three, and another $10,000 in year four. So I could just carry it forward. And so you kind of look at it. Otherwise, I'm going to need to be a real estate professional.
So they do say it's owned by an LLC, but what they have to keep in mind is, supposing that it's owned by an LLC, taxes a partnership, or taxes an S corporation, that income or that loss in this case comes through to the individual exactly the same way it would if it was on your return to start with.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't change how that loss is treated just because it came from somewhere else.
Very cool. I have a C corporation and purchase a fix and flip. After renovation, I am unable to sell the property. Well, that sucks. If I refinance it and pay a business credit card off as part of the refinancing, can I transfer it to my holding LLC as a personal rental? What, if any, would be the tax liability, and how do I do it to make sure it is done legally? So you want to whack this one, or you want me to knock it out?
Well, anytime you transfer a property out of a corporation, you have to recognize the difference between your costs and the fair market value.
Mm-hmm. In this case, they lost money.
You sure about that?
Yeah, I'm unable to sell. Well, I guess that's an assumption. After renovation, I'm unable to sell the property. So I'm assuming that they're not able to sell the property, because if they did, they would take a loss. Does that make sense? Because why would you? Yeah, nobody sell it, because all I would do is just keep lowering the price otherwise. Mm-hmm. If it's in a C corp, so there's a couple different things. So first off, it depends on whether you filed a tax return, you've actually captured it in there, as to whether you just want to stick it in the corp. Sometimes you look at it and you go, oh man, this was really a holding. And you just kind of do a change of mind, and you transfer the expenses associated with it. I'm not perfectly comfortable with that. So I'd probably do an easier one, which is I would just sell it at my basis to my own LLC. And so I would just buy it out of there. And that way I would put it in my holding company. It's probably going to cost me a few $100 to do the transfer of title. But now I actually have basis, and I have my basis on renting for my rental, which will allow me to do a couple different things. First off, the corporation's going to be able to recoup all of its expenses, pay off any of its bills and everything else. Mm-hmm. And depending on it should have zero gain if it's selling it for I'm assuming again that they didn't make a ton of money on it because they can't sell it. And number two, that gives me a higher basis for my depreciation. I could sell it at a loss, but it has to be fair market value. So I could sell it at a loss. The loss then sticks inside the C corp, which isn't necessarily a really bad thing.
Now, I would consider renting it within the C corp, but keeping it on the market to sell.
If that's your intent, and so really, if you bought it to sell it, then the intent sticks with that thing for years. So even if it's 10 years from now, it's still a flip. It's still inventory.
Correct.
So I don't know if I get to depreciate it.
Hmm? You can change intent within the C corp.
You can't. I either bought it with the intent to sell it, which case it's inventory. So this is the same thing as buying Cheerios at a mini mart, and I put it on the shelf and it sits there for 10 years. I don't get to do anything with that inventory. I either get rid of it, dump it, have somebody liquidate it, dump it in a dumpster, whatever. But I'm not going to do that with my real estate. My real estate, I want to make it to where I can depreciate it so I get some benefit out of it. In order to do that, I really need it to be in the hand of an investor. And so my flipping entity is not an investor. I would need to sell it to my LLC, and it could be my LLC, and I could even have it carry the note. I believe I could just sit there and do it that way. I don't have taxable gain. So let the corporation carry the note. So then I just go about my merry way of renting it, depreciation, pay back the corporation over time.
It actually works better if there is a note attached, because then you're pulling less out of that corporation.
Yeah,
absolutely. C corporation, when you have a C corporation, my problem with the C corp is I can only deduct up to 10% of my net income. So it's net taxable income out of the C corp. So I really wouldn't get any benefit out of the C corp. I really need to have it out in my name. You got a question?
Can you change intent from becoming inventory to...
It's a case-by-case, fact-based scenario where they look at the intent at the time of purchase. So the case that we always point to is a guy who bought a warehouse, intended to sell it. The economy started shifting. Every year he would go through and look and see what the market looked like. 10 years later, he sold it, and he took it and he treated it as long-term capital gains. And the IRS said, no, your intent when you bought it was to sell it. It was inventory the whole time, and, you know, blew him up. That was 10 years, not a year, 10 years. Yeah, so what we like to do, and this is, you'd actually see this exact example in a couple of the tax journals. They say if you're flipping a property and you end up getting stuck with it, sell it to an out, sell it to your own entity outside of that business. You can do it on an installment note. The corporation would treat that as a sale on day one, even though they're getting the money over time. But remember, this is a situation where we probably be really close to breaking even. There's not going to be a taxable event to the corporation. And now I have a piece of property that I can depreciate. I can even do accelerated depreciation on it. And, you know, hopefully I'm renting it out and I'm not going to be paying tax on it.
Third party entity didn't have any money to pay it on the note. Could you do a demand note?
Right. If the third party entity did not have the money to pay the note, could you do a third party demand note? Technically, I think you could, but you'd want to make an installment election. So I think you're going to make it an installment note because you want to, well, actually, will it even matter? Actually, you probably could do a demand note, huh?
Yeah, you would need to make the installment election. It's inventory anyway.
It's inventory, so I think you could do a demand note. Actually, I think you're right. Would you? I'm trying to think of a situation. Maybe if I sold it.
I'm not completely comfortable with the demand note because IRS may deem it not a completed sale, that it never actually happened. If you're not have a plan to.
The way I've seen it is installment. I would probably want to dig, and I would say the installment is, again, is. Would you sell, if it was you, would you sell it to a third party on a demand note? Hey, I'll just let you know when you should need to pay me for it. I mean, I guess if I was really flush and the circumstances were such where I didn't need the cash and I wanted a little bit of interest, maybe I would. But otherwise, I'm probably saying, hey, I made a mistake on this one. I just want to sell it and get my money back, and I can't sell it to anybody else. So I'm going to sell it to myself. That's the only thing I could think of. Or you said, hey, I have a change of heart. I really don't want to flip this house. I want to keep it. In which case, you got to make sure that you're changing it to a different taxpayer. And you're a different taxpayer than that C corp. So if I sell it to an LLC that flows onto me, I am the taxpayer they're looking at. And so that would probably be a better route.
The client has a disregarded LLC to their 1040. They want to write off as many expenses as they can. They don't expect to have income for 2 to 3 years in that LLC. They have a home office, car usage, cell phone, etc. And they want to know what they can write off.
Wow, so it's a sole proprietorship, right? And they're going to lose money 2 to 3 years. Yeah, then I'm probably not going to be. I'm going to say to them, or what do you guys think we should do? If we're going to lose money in a sole proprietor, what do we probably want to do?
Create a C corp.
Probably create a C corp. I'm probably going to say, hey, keep yourself out of the Section 183. Keep yourself away from being declared a hobby. If you are going to be like this, is it depending on what your income is and how hard you're working at the business? If you're going to be a sole proprietor and you really want to make sure that you're covering your bases, I cannot imagine a sole proprietorship that would be treated as running in a business-like manner. It's almost impossible. So they're going to have to set it up. If it's already an LLC disregarded, I would make sure that they have a business plan, a bookkeeper, and a good accountant if they're going to try to keep it that way. And the only way I would keep it that way is if you saw a light at the end of the tunnel and you were going to take those losses and it was going to give you some serious benefit, like you have a high income, and then I would use those losses to offset the high income, then it would probably be worth the risk. Otherwise, I'm just setting up a C corp and I'm carrying forward those losses and offsetting the gains in the future. And that way I take the pressure off.
How can it be beneficial from a tax standpoint when the repairs and rehab are performed after purchasing a rental property?
Well, the repairs and maintenance, and I was talking this with some other clients, is that a lot of times those rehabs are nothing more than repairs and maintenance. You've bought this property, it's a wreck, and you're bringing the property back up to standard.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, so you're going to be able to deduct those against any income you earn on that property.
You can't create a loss if it's abandoned. Like if it's not rented, I believe that's right.
Right.
If you have the repairs and maintenance and it creates a loss out of that property, you can't take them. You're carrying them forward until you actually have rents. If it's already being rented, then you just go ahead and the repairs and maintenance, you're immediately deducting against it. So it's not a bad thing. If you're improving the property and you're like, hey, I'm making big changes, adding, then it just adds to the basis. And in that particular case, what might we do, class? If we just did a big improvement on a property that we were renting and we were worried about taxes, we wanted to offset our tax, we're going to do a cost segregation and we're going to break that into 5, 7, 15-year property and decide which portion we may want to take. We don't have to even take bonus depreciation. We could just do that. Other question?
The property is not rented for a certain period of time. Do we take the mortgage interest as a deduction during that time?
All right. So if the property is not rented during a certain period of time, do we write it off personally, the mortgage interest? Is that what you're talking about? Or can we always take the mortgage interest as a deduction if it's an investment property. Right. The problem that we have is I don't think that we can take the repairs and maintenance as if we create a loss. So you can always do the other. But remember, it's passive activity. So you still have passive activity loss rules. So even if I create a loss, I'm not offsetting my personal income. There is one other exception I didn't go over, which is if you're making $100,000 or less, you can take $25,000 of a deduction if you're actively participating on that real estate. I didn't give that a fair shake. Otherwise, your passive activity losses are always zero. Your capital losses are $3,000. But so we sometimes confuse those two. But if you have passive activity losses, then it's just, they just carry forward. If I have losses on a piece of property and my income's low enough, I can use up to $25,000 as a active participant. That is the other, there's a small exception. It phases out $1 for every $2 you go above $100,000. So as soon as you hit $150,000 of income, now it's phased out and your only game in town is real estate professional.
And keep in mind, there's a difference between if the property is rented or if the property is available to rent.
If it's available to rent,
then you can take all your deductions because you're trying to rent it out. But if it's not available to rent.
Yeah, that's true.
So it doesn't matter if anybody's in there. It matters more whether or not you're actively trying to rent the property. Now, if you're tearing the kitchen out and stuff like that, it's obviously not available to rent.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Other question?
What is the difference between startup costs and organizational costs? And could you provide an example of each?
Startup costs are those costs.
These guys all know that now.
You want to ask them?
What's a startup cost, guys?
$5,000.
Up to $5,000. But give me an example of a startup cost.
Education.
Education, something that I did. Anything that would have been deductible to the company before. Investigation, anything there. Yeah, so... What is it?
R&D,
research and development. And then the organizational cost is what?
Filing fees.
Accounting. The cost for the LLC. Yep, you guys are good. See? I'll just have you guys do Tax Tuesday from now on.
When y'all do your IPOs, that will be part of your new organizational expenses.
If I am self-employed or own a small business, are the health insurance premiums tax deductible? Well, this is interesting. Read it carefully. All right, so here's the deal. If I'm self-employed and if you're a sole proprietor, then you can write off yourself and you can, I think you still can write off. Is it on your 1040?
Yeah.
You're still writing off your insurance premiums. So this is the operative word right here. So the premiums could still be deductible. We have things like copays and other things that we really care about. Could we write those off? Not if I am self-employed as a sole proprietorship or as an S-corp, but could I do it as a C-corp?
Yes,
absolutely. So if I'm self-employed or own a small business, are the health insurance premiums tax deductible? The answer is yes. If I want to write off anything more than that, the answer is no, unless I'm a C-corp.
And something most people do not know, Medicare premiums that you pay through Social Security, those are also deductible if you're self-employed, just like your other insurance premiums are. You do it through an S corporation. The S corporation has to reimburse you for those Medicare premiums.
Medicare, cool. How about what is it? Medi-Cal?
Medi-Cal probably also. And if Elliot here owns a business and both him and his wife are paying Medicare, because he's really, really old. He can deduct a self-employed insurance for both him and his spouse.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. C Corp, we can just reimburse everything. We don't have to care about any of that.
Yeah.
You keep working on that. Christian-based, there's actually MediShare and a few others. Those count. And actually, some of those are really good. Like, I have some. It's cheaper. You just have to certify that you're Christian. So some people get all weird about that.
And most of the cost-sharing ones will provide you with some type of documentation.
What those are considered is a high-deductible plan, or in that case, they're going to have a limitation, so you're going to need a catastrophic illness plan. So there'll be a small maintenance, so a lot of like the MediShares, it's covering pretty much everything other than really, really bad stuff going on. So like cancer and things like that, not going to be covered. But if you want to go to the doctor, it's going to cover everything. And so what a lot of folks will do is they'll do like the MediShare. It's pretty cheap. It's like $300 a month or something. And then they'll do a real high deductible medical plan, knowing that you're going to, the base stuff is all being covered under this plan. And then by the time it kicks into the higher amounts, you've already got your coverage. So does anybody do that in here, by the way? A few of you guys, is that an accurate assessment? They pay for everything, even high stuff?
There's no maximum.
A serious illness.
Which company is it?
Liberty HealthShare.
Liberty HealthShare.
You just have to be very honest when you fill out the form that you have no pre-existing conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And they are amazing.
Yeah, that's a great testimonial.
So everybody's a little different. I know that some of these have caps, but you're saying that Liberty...
Liberty HealthShare.
Liberty HealthShare.
We got to take a look at Liberty HealthShare because there's so many floating around out there. But again, all I can go off of is my experience. That's really great to hear because they're constantly morphing. So
they are very, very slow to pay. But they pay.
But they do pay.
And you could go to any doctor that you want, which is amazing in this day and age. You don't have to play the game of who's on your plan or who's not. You just go to any doctor.
So what she's saying is Liberty MediShare. They're a little bit slow to pay, but they cover everything. You can even go to your own doctor. That's for the people that are out there.
That's interesting. What was the price on a monthly basis?
$499 a month for us and our two teenage
So $4.99 a month for you and your teenage. I've seen that. It's the health sharing plans. There's a few faith-based plans that are out there. And what? Yeah. No, some do, some don't. There was about three or four that we've run across. And here's the thing: is that the organization itself, the exception outside of the Obamacare was that they were faith-based, and so that they couldn't impose that upon them because they were already they're outside of it. Yeah, let's keep jumping on because we're at 352. What is the difference between a solo 401k, QRP, and cash balance pension? Also, if my portfolio is just passive income and I only take cash distributions, is there a workaround to establish a 401k? Do you want me to knock it?
I'll hit the first part. A QRP is qualified retirement plans, and they're typically what we call defined contribution plans, which a 401k is. A lot of the profit sharing plans are also QRPs. A cash balanced pension plan is a defined benefit plan. Have you all talked about the differences in those?
Okay. We talked about defined benefit, just for everybody that's not it, that wasn't in this room, is we're reverse engineering it. We're figuring out what your benefit's going to be. Usually you're taking 3 years, taking a look at your average income, and then we give that to an actuary and say, in order for me to get that benefit when I retire, how much do I have to have in my plan? And they do a calculation based on your age, the growth, projected growth on the plan, inflation, and then they also cap the benefit at 220 some odd thousand. I think it's 220,000. So that if you're making $500,000 a year, you don't get to say, how do I make $500,000 a year out of the DB? They're going to say, how do I make $220,000 or whatever that limit is? And then your actuary does the calculation of what you can put into the plan.
Now, the client asks if his portfolio is just passive income and they only take cash distributions. Is there a workaround to establish the 401k? Unfortunately, no. The 401k, all of the defined contribution plans, the IRAs, Roth and traditional, require that you have earned income.
Mm-hmm. There's one case. So if you have a portfolio that is passive income, and I'm assuming that it's rental, real estate, or trading, then what you can do is you could have that be in an LLC with the corporation as a manager or a limited partnership with a general partner that's a corporation, with the idea that then we're able to push that money into the corporation and the corporation can then turn around and fund a 401k. The bad side to that is you just took passive income and made it active. The good side is we get some deferral if you need it. So it's always about doing the math and seeing whether it's worth it or not. Billy.
Professional is considered active. Would that work or not?
Even so then, real estate professional is the exception to the passive activity loss rules. It's still considered a passive activity. That's why your rental income still goes on your Schedule E as passive, even though your depreciation is treated as an active loss. So it's the best of both worlds.
Yeah. Active and earned are not the same thing. For example, if you're running a bakery through your S corporation and you get a K-1 that says you have $100,000 ordinary income, that is active income, but it's not considered earned income.
It's not subject to self-employment tax. Fun stuff. All right, keep going on. How do I sell a husband and wife owns C-Corp to reduce taxes? Well, so there's two things that you look at. Whenever you sell a business, your best bet is to sell the shares of the company, and you're going to be treated as long-term capital gains. Depending on when this business was set up, you may have a small business exception where you have zero tax on those capital gains. So if it's a husband and wife C-Corp, they may qualify to not pay any tax, depending on how long they held it. But worst case scenario is if you sell it, you could be treated as long-term capital gains if you sell the shares. Now, if I'm a buyer of a company, do I want to buy shares? Why not? Besides liability, I also can't depreciate it. It's like if I buy Microsoft shares, can I depreciate it? No, I'm buying the shares. So when you have a C-Corp and you want to reduce taxes, realistically, I'm selling the shares. Or if I have a larger company, let's say we're over 20 million, probably 20 to 30 million, then what I could do is take those shares, toss them into an LLC, and sell that to an irrevocable trust for the benefit of a third party like my kids or some other organization. I would step up my basis the day that I stuck that into that entity when it purchased it. So it could sell those shares and pay zero capital gains. I have an installment sale where I'm recognizing that income over a long period of time. And that way I am getting long-term capital gains spread out over, and sometimes it's 20, 30 years, so I get paid. So there's ways. It's called a deferred sales trust. So there's always a way to do some things. If you're ever in a situation where you're going to sell a business, you should have somebody go through the scenarios, and you'd be shocked. I've walked in on, at the last minute on, what was the funniest one, it was about a $7 million sale. And the party that was selling it had no idea that they were going to, the other side was buying the assets, and they had no idea that they were going to have ordinary income treatment and not long-term care treatment. And I had another one that was, again, about a $7 million sale where they were buying the assets of a company, but they were buying the company itself. And so they thought that they were going to be able to depreciate it. The lawyers never looked at it and never explained to them that they couldn't write it off. So the guy literally freaked out at the last second because the attorneys never addressed the tax. And he said, hey, could you take a look at it? It was a buddy of mine. And I was like, yeah, that's not very smart. You're going to buy the shares? And he was like, yeah, why? Because I said, well, kids, you can't write it off. And he goes, what? I said, yeah, you got to buy the assets so you can depreciate them. Otherwise, you're coming out of pocket the whole dollars. You're never going to get write off. Again, it's like buying $7 million of Microsoft shares. You get no tax benefit until you sell it, right? So there is a hybrid. And that is if you are an S-Corp and you're buying and selling through an S-Corp. Technically, I guess you could sell through a C. But the party who is acquiring the shares treats it as an asset sale. Actually, both parties treat it as an asset sale. And it depends on what assets you're buying. But the party ends up, you're selling the shares, so you're getting rid of the liability, but you're still treating it as an asset sale. I believe that's
right.
That's 338H10, yep. Where you're able to kind of get the best of both worlds. And then it depends on what the assets they're buying. If they're buying a lot of goodwill, you're going to spread that income over a long period of time. Right, we gotta get skedaggling. How is a series LLC and operating LLC reported on a personal tax return? Well, let me just knock this one out. A series LLC is just a fancy way of saying LLC after LLC after LLC under one filing with the state. Each series, we still have to designate how it's going to be taxed with the federal government. Do the feds recognize LLCs?
No.
Right, so we have to go through, and we have to, so it depends on, because we could treat each one of those series as a C corp. In which case, how is it reported on your personal tax return? It's not. If each one of these is disregarded for tax purposes, then it's no different than you owning it individually. If each, and by the way, you could have a series that's taxed as a partnership, one as a disregarded entity, one as a C-Corp. one as an S corp. Like, it's literally whatever you feel like calling it. So again, just kind of look at that. And it's you know, when we're just looking at an LLC, just remember the feds just kind of ignore it. Can I offset gains from rents with depreciation?
Yes.
Always. We can always write it off with depreciation. So we can offset our gains, unless we're talking about what, possibly if it's capital gains from stock,
right,
then you wouldn't look at depreciation. But if this is real estate, then the answer is yes.
Attention all real estate investors, business owners, stock traders, and anyone looking to get out of the rat race for good. We all know time is money, but did you know there's a wealth of resources on how to make more money, keep more money, and protect what you've earned all for free online? Anderson Business Advisors YouTube channel offers free resources on asset protection and tax reduction from lawyers and CPAs designed to help you keep more money in your pocket. To learn how to limit your liability, protect what you've earned, and minimize your tax burden all for free, subscribe to Anderson Business Advisors on YouTube today.
How can you determine the comparable square footage used for the meeting room when soliciting rental costs for the 280A 14-day rule? Again, if you're renting your house, I would just look at your total area that you're going to be using. So this isn't your administrative office. If I am renting my house to a corporation, I'm saying which portions of the house am I looking at? And then you want comparable space. So I would be looking in similar accommodations. So if I'm renting my house and I have a big house, beautiful house, I'm not going with a crappy little room and a Comfort Inn, right? I want to have something that's comparable to it.
And when you're getting these comps for your meetings, you're not going to be calling Quality Inn and saying, I want 150 square feet. You're going to tell them how many people are going to be there, what kind of accommodations you want, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And the real expense is I need to have internet, I need to have a TV, I need to have connectivity. And you'll realize that that's very expensive in a hotel. And that's, again, that's what you're using as your comp. Yeah.
Can you use our whole house square footage for that?
Can you use your what?
Whole house square footage for that?
If you're going to use the full house for the meeting, I don't, and it's like, the, it'd be kind of weird to use your bedrooms. Depends on the meeting.
Why did you take the
Honey, I think we did really well this quarter.
Let's make some babies.
Let's have a party. Yeah, the treats are in the other room. Yeah, no, don't do that. I expect to receive $35,000 to $45,000 capital gain from real estate sin. Okay. I want to keep my AGI down and I'm thinking about investing in an opportunity zone deal that has a minimum investment of $50,000. So what they're really looking at, we haven't hit the opportunity zone. We're going to do it after to here for the group in here. But an opportunity zone is just a fancy way of saying I can defer my capital gain and I can defer it for up to right now 7 years. Next year will be 6 years. But it has to be capital gain in order to qualify. I will need to sell some stock that have gain to make up the difference. Can I mix the two types of gain, real estate and stock, for this single investment? What documents will I need to make sure? You don't have to get into that. Yes, you can. You can mix the two. It's capital gains. The form that you actually file is with the, actually, are you doing it on the individual? You're doing a qualified opportunity zone fund that's going to file the form. You are going to file a form on your 1040 that says, these were the funds that I invested in a qualified opportunity zone.
Yeah, so you're just reporting capital gains as you normally would on your tax return. And there is a code that you use, I think it's Z, for adjustment code. That basically says, I'm putting all this into an opportunity zone.
And it's deferred. I'll show you guys how it works. I mean, actually, I'll just go over it real quick. After 5 years, your basis steps up 10%. So if I have, if I put $50,000 into a qualified opportunity zone fund, then I will have to pay tax on that $50,000 in 7 years, except I don't have to pay tax on the full 50. 10% of it steps up in year five, another 5% in year seven, which means I'm going to pay tax on 85% of that 50, which is some number, $42,500. And it'll be like, I'll be paying capital gains on that in 7 years, but only on 85% of it. And then if I leave that money in my opportunity zone fund, invested in opportunity zone property, for 10 years, I pay zero tax on any of those gains. So if I hold it for 20 years and that $50,000 becomes worth $150,000, how much tax am I, you know, what's the total amount of income I paid tax on? I invested 50. It's now worth 150. I paid tax on 42,500 of it in year 7, and that's the only time I'll pay tax. So I got to have 150 grand. Yeah, so that's why people do it. Keep running on. I own an online business and I'm out of the country most of the year. I can qualify for foreign earned income exclusion. Is there a strategy where I can still contribute to my IRA or 401k?
This kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the needing earned income to have a 401k. What the foreign earned income exclusion does is it says, oh, this money was actually earned in another country that you spend the majority of your time in and so forth. But what that does is that lowers the amount of earned income you have. It's not going to take it down to zero. But say you receive a W-2 from Conoco for $100,000 a year for working in Angola. That's pretty specific. And you make an exclusion for $75,000, $85,000 of that. So you're only going to report $15,000 of W-2 wages on your tax return.
Mm-hmm.
So you only have that much earned income to use to produce an IRA.
Yeah, in the 401k is still going to need a business sponsor.
Right.
So if you're working out of the country, you're going to be having to look. I don't think you can do a 401k off of a foreign entity. It needs to be sponsored by a domestic entity. So what you'd have to do is more than likely have a U.S. counterpart where you're able to generate some income. Technically, you could do that through a sole proprietorship. Although I wouldn't advise it for all the reasons we've gone over in the last couple of days. Yes, sir.
Citizen, aren't they taxed on worldwide income?
You have a foreign earned income exclusion when you're out of the country. It's usually about $180,000.
Yeah. So there's actually two benefits. There's that foreign earned income exclusion, which excludes a certain amount. And then any taxes you paid on that money, the remaining amount, you can use as a credit. So it's not double. You don't get double taxed on it for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it sounds like he has a business. But, you know, again, we'd have to, it's very fact specific. I have 3 kids. Can I pay them a modeling fee for multiple companies that I own for modeling? So it sounds like they have a whole bunch of different companies probably doing different types of modeling for different types of medium. For example, if I have 5 companies, can all 3 kids be paid modeling fees from all 5 companies if they were truly models for that company and what is customary in the business? What say you guys?
Yeah,
the answer is yes. So as long as they're actually doing something, can the companies each pay them a salary? Yes. If they're paying them a salary, then it really depends on the type of business as to whether you still have to do payroll taxes and things like that. So if these are all 5 companies, they're all sole proprietors, which is going to be kind of weird. Maybe they're disregarded LLCs. Then you wouldn't have to worry about it. If it's an S-Corp or a C-Corp, then you'd have some payroll taxes. But yeah, you can pay the kids. I have multiple. And by the way, if you're going to pay the kids, guys, and they have active income, what should we be looking at setting up for these kids? A Roth IRA, absolutely. It's like a savings account. Yes, sir.
Am I in the kiddie tax rule?
Kiddie tax rule is if a child is under 18, any passive income is added to the parent's tax return. If they're 18 to 24 and you're providing more than 50% of their assistance and they're going to college, then it's also included. So it can go up to 24, I believe. Am I 24 or 23?
24, I believe.
I think it's 24. But if they're active income, you don't have to worry about it. So the reason the kiddie rule is there, so I don't give them a piece of a limited partnership that holds an investment in an apartment complex and all that income gets allocated to the kid. And the kid's like, ha, 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 you know, I just got $50,000 at my tax bracket and they have a standard deduction of $12,000. So they're not paying much in taxes. They're just going to add that back into the parents saying that child didn't do anything. So, but if they're working for it, then they're okay. Yes, ma'am.
Kids, 1099 instead of salary. That's where they, you know.
Can you pay the kids 1099? Technically, you probably could if the kid, you know, but then they're a sole proprietor. A little bit weird, and whether they could contract. So I'm kind of like, depending on how old the child is, I probably wouldn't do that. This is a funny one. I have multiple companies and would like to have board meetings or meetings for the companies for 14 days. Can I rent out a room and then pay each company the market equivalent of 14 days of rental income for the exact 14 days? Yes, taxpayer. So what we really care about is the companies aren't getting paid. The companies are paying you. You're going the wrong direction. So you want the company to pay you. And no, you can't, like 14 days for the taxpayer. So if it's you, spouse, or just you, it's 14 days. If you're the taxpayer, it's 14 days. Now, again, somebody points out that the code doesn't say that it's per taxpayer 14 days. It's 14 days per dwelling unit, but the courts have already said 14 days or less. I'm not going to argue with the judge just because, well, I think you lose. I think the congressional intent was 14 days. So what they look at is, could I, by the way, rent 3 days to this company, 3 days to this company, 3 days to this other company? Yeah. Could my corporation do 14 days with my house and 14 days with my business partner's house? Yeah. It just has to be reasonable. And, you know, making sure that companies have board meetings all the time or have meetings all the time. It doesn't even have to be a board meeting. It should be, I just want to use your house. Yes, sir.
What, if you own two different houses?
Two different houses, two different corporations. If you're the taxpayer, it's 14 days between the two. Or three, or four, or five, because you could have an RV, a boat, a vacation rental, and a personal residence, and I'm doing them all. It's still 14 days. It makes it non-taxable. Now, I could rent all those things out and go beyond 14 days, but then what happens? It's taxable to me now. Yeah, so I may not want to do it. If I want to reimburse myself on a per diem basis for corporate travel rather than using a Spanx reimbursement, how do I go about it? I can figure out the per diem amount for each trip on the IRS website, but there is no form. What document is required for per diem reimbursement?
It's called an expense report.
Yeah, it's an expense report, but even more importantly, if you are a greater than 10% shareholder in a company, you cannot use per diem.
I'm generally not in favor of using per diem. I don't find it to be advantageous.
It's not advantageous necessarily for you. I mean, it depends. If it's really a low amount and you have employees that don't own your company, yeah, use a per diem. It's a little bit easier. You're not worried about them running up a big old Amex bill or something like that when they're going out. They're not going to, hey, let's order a bunch of different, what's some really expensive wine? Like, yeah, we had caviar, lobster, and some champagne. Yeah, some Dom Perignon. Yeah, if I just do the per diem, I'm just like, here it is. But you can't do that for yourself and your own company.
So when I was getting per diem for like traveling to Los Angeles, I was eating at McDonald's every day and pocketing the rest.
You know, we did that once. Our guys would just sit there and it was so hilarious. We went to the per diem route like about 20 years ago, and they were all staying at Super 8 and like, and we're like, you're showing up at events late, and you look like someone ran over you in the bus, and they're like, but I saved some money. I'm like, yeah, thanks for doing that for us, guys. You never did that, right? Yeah. And then let's see, I have multiple companies and would like to have board meetings. We already do
that's
one.
That's the one we just said.
All right, we already did that one. All right, I have 8 units in my own name. Will I save on taxes if I transfer them under my LLC? So it sounds like real estate. And the answer is no. It doesn't make any difference. Yeah, it's all going to flow down to you anyway. See, you guys already know this stuff. If you put it in a C-Corp, it's probably not going to save you any taxes. If you transfer into an LLC, that's not going to be a 501c3 for sure, because we're going to use a corp. But yeah, there's no real benefit. There's no real benefit. It's not going to make a difference. Usually LLCs, especially in real estate, are tax neutral. We're not using them for taxes other than we can have a management company and that we have a statutory basis to put money into the management company. But we're not using it for anything else other than really asset protection. And from an estate planning standpoint, if you own properties in your own name, you have to probate in every state that you own property. So if you pass away and you have property in 8 states, guess what you're doing? Well, no, you're dead. You're laughing from a cloud or looking up laughing. No, I'm just kidding.
Hot, 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 hot.
Right, right. It's hot up down here, but look at my kids. They're having to probate everywhere. Yeah, no. So under those circumstances, you just left a little bit of a mess behind for other people. I've been through that. So like my grandma, we ended up not taking any of her properties because there were like lots, small lots, really inexpensive lots in Alabama and Florida. And my dad, when she passed, they were supposed to be the beneficiaries, but we had to probate it. And it was more expensive to pay the lawyers than the lots were worth. And so literally, we just kind of, he was in Washington and you'd have to go back down to Alabama and Florida several times. And he's like, nope. Give it back to the state. So that's why you use the LLCs. Get them out. Or you just use a living trust or a land trust. Any of those work. It gets it out of your name. You just don't want to personally own it. I had recently retired from my job and had a direct rollover into a traditional IRA to self-direct the account into buying real estate properties. Is it better to convert the account now to a Roth IRA for tax purposes since I'm anticipating expanding my real estate venture in the future? Which will benefit me more in terms of taxes when I sell the properties?
Now, here's the thing. The key sentence here is I anticipate expanding my real estate. And the only way you can do that within a retirement plan, you can't throw more money into it, is by making a bundle on the property you already own.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the case, then, and he's sure he's going to make a lot of money in this IRA, I would consider converting it to a Roth IRA. Now, the problem with that is you got to pay tax on what's already in there.
Don't. Based off its value too. So we already know, we did the math. When would this possibly make sense to do a conversion? In a year where my taxes are higher, in a year where my taxes are low?
The following year.
Right, so this particular case, he says, I recently retired from my job. So I'd probably be looking at the year following the rollover, saying, hey, how much are you gonna make? How much is this worth? Maybe we roll it over because you're not gonna pay much tax at all, and then you'll never pay tax again. Now, the one thing that I look at here is when you say expanding my real estate venture in the future, when you expand real estate, what does it require? Money. And if it's a Roth IRA, are we going to be able to get a whole bunch more money into that Roth IRA?
No.
So what are we going to need to use? We're going to need debt. And if we have debt, we're probably going to need to stay in a 401k. So under this particular circumstance, if I saw a rollover, I'd be looking at setting up a 401k in a small company and rolling that money over into the 401k so I can use debt to grow it. And I'm probably not going to convert it, but I could convert it, pieces of it, over the year. So I could take a piece that's in my 401k and convert portions of it. I could roll it into an IRA, just like one property. Let's say I had multiple pieces of property. I could roll one property and pay a small amount of tax on each one of those and convert that into a Roth IRA. And I could do that every year. I don't have to do all of it. I could just say, hey, you know what? I'm just going to keep doing this. And, you know, realistically, I'd have to have a pretty low tax amount. And if they're retired, there's no way that it's going to pencil out. I can already tell you, every time I look at this, when somebody's retired, they have such a small horizon. You just don't want to take that tax hit. You had a question?
So if you're thinking about maybe opening an S Corp and have a company sponsored 401k,
mm-hmm.
and roll over the IRA to regular traditional 401k,
yeah.
And then, if there's an active income generated somewhere in that S Corp, and pay maybe make a negative, can you offset the income from the 401k by rolling over? So when you pay yourself employer contribution, it's a negative number to the company.
So if you create a loss in an S Corp, so what he's saying, the guys online probably can't hear it, but what he said is, what if I create an S Corp that sponsored a 401k? Could I create a loss in the S Corp so that I was able to do the rollover without having a taxable event? Yeah, you could do that. You could try to do that. You have to have basis in the S Corp. So you actually have to have the money coming from somewhere. So you got to have some money lying around to put into it. And then you're creating it by paying it. You're buying $50,000. You could kind of play that game. I'd have to play the numbers. I think it's probably going to be more hassle than it's worth. The easier thing to do is just to say, hey, you know what? I'm going to be in a pretty low tax bracket here in a few years, depending on what my retirement income is. Maybe I'll do some conversions. Maybe I won't. If I'm building real estate and the operative word was I want to expand, then I'm probably not going to play too many games. I'm just going to try to grow my real estate. And I'm going to need to use a 401k for that so I can use debt finance income. That's just me. Otherwise, you're probably going to you're putting yourself behind an eight ball. Yes, ma'am.
I have a 401k that purchased a condo, and it's mm-hmm. on Airbnb.
Mm-hmm.
All of the income from Airbnb goes directly into the solo 401k.
Mm-hmm.
But Airbnb issues you a 1099.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do with that 1099?
The 1099 should be issued to the custodian,
yep.
not you. They should not be issuing it. It'll be the custodian's EIN, not your Social Security number, not the IRA's EIN or Social Security number.
The only thing I don't know is whether that's going to be UBIT or not. Unrelated business income tax, because it's an active business.
And that's why I thought the Airbnb is probably UBIT.
Yeah.
You may have to pay tax on
Airbnb, anytime you have a less than 7 days on average for is 28 days average that you're doing it. So you're doing big, long chunks, then you're going to be fine.
That's fine.
Yeah, then you're fine. If it's 7 days or less, then it's considered hotel and it's active. So
I've heard does not have UBIT versus the SDIRA that has UBIT.
No, you always have you're thinking of debt financing. Yeah, UBIT's always on any exempt organization, including even a 501c3, an IRA, 401k, defined benefit, cash balance. QRP is a 401k or 401a, all of those. You always have unrelated business income tax, because what they don't want is an exempt organization competing with a traditional business. Here, we got to run through these. I have a personal home. This is the last one, I think. I have a personal home and rural land in my personal name. I want to be able to isolate it from future ventures as well as be able to pass it on to my sons when the time comes. I live in Colorado and have an LLC that was established a year ago without any holdings. It is registered here in Colorado. Do I use this existing LLC on the ranch, or I go with a trust and use the LLC for a future real estate move? So they have a personal home and rural land in my personal name. I want to be able to isolate it. And there's really two items there. So they must be saying it's all one big thing. Pass it on to my son when the time comes. So it's kind of a weird. How would you answer? What's that?
Use both.
You could do that. Yes. So here's the deal. If you have a single owner LLC in Colorado, is a separate property state. So whatever we're going to do, we want to make sure that if we set up an LLC, it's disregarded. Partnership will destroy your what's called a 121 exclusion. So and if we want it to go to your kids, we probably want to make sure that we're protected from them. And realistically, all you really need here is a living trust. If I'm concerned about the rural land, I'm probably, if it's separate parceled, I'm putting that in an LLC. But the actual personal residence, you know, what you could do is kind of a, you know, it's kind of an advanced strategy is you use what's called a qualified personal residence trust, a QPERT, where you put it into trust. Nobody, and you have a right to remain in that property until you die. And then it goes to your family. And that way nobody could ever take it away from you. So like if you're ever worried about having liabilities or whatnot, you know, and you're like, you know, a lot of us worry about medical bills and things like that. So that would be one possibility. The other route is just put it in a living trust.
And the other issue here is they do mention the term, it's a ranch, and you see this also with farms and all. Working ranches, working farms, things of that nature, that some of the property may be business related, even though they live on that ranch. That's where their resident is. So sometimes it has to be broken out separately.
All right, we're going to knock out a couple little things tax-wise. You guys are in the last one right now. So you could still, before the end of the year, you could still sign up to have recordings of all three tax-wise. They're $197. And get two tickets to the Tax and Asset Protection Workshop. Get Clint's book. Where is it? Actually, sitting right here. Asset Protection for Real Estate Investors. And it has a three-part video series online, strategy session with the blueprint. You can do that. It's $197. I'm not going to spend too much time on that because we're getting towards the end of the year. But you do get recordings even for this event if somebody needs that. iTunes, our podcast is free. On Google Play, we're also free. Replays of all of our Tax Tuesdays are available in your Platinum portal if you're Platinum. If you're not Platinum, then I believe that there's usually three or four of them hanging around out there at any given time that you can go back and listen to. I like the podcasts. From what I'm hearing from people is that they don't necessarily watch them all, but they definitely like to go listen to them, and they put us on 1.5 speed so they don't have to go through the full thing.
That's funny.
I could not handle listening to myself on 1.5 speed. I think I talk fast enough as it is. All right. And then, of course, the all social media. Hey, for everybody here and everybody out there in internet land, Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors, feel free to email in questions. And guys, that's where I grab those questions from every time. I just go through and see what's there that's making sense. And I shouldn't even say me. Kendall goes through them first, and she takes the ones that, again, are very specific or very time urgent, gives them to somebody right away. And then the other ones we put in questions. I'll actually show you the sheet so you guys can freak out a little bit how many questions we actually get. It's pretty funny. But as you guys are probably aware now, it's just question after question after question. You guys are starting to see that sometimes the answer is we need more facts. We need to dig into it a little bit. But there's usually more than one option. Whereas I guarantee you that if you gave that to your local accountant, the answer is going to be no, no, I don't know. No, 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 no. Depends, knows. Yeah. Anyway, so shoot in Tax Tuesday. It's free. If you have people that are that you work with or that you like that are investors, have them in. Like, there's no cost to it. And a lot of folks, they stick with that same accountant or professional. And we don't want to break through, but sometimes they're not getting an answer. And if they can come on to Tax Tuesday, there's never a cost to it, and we can give them the answer. We can give them the code provision. You guys don't see what goes on behind the scenes, but when we're answering questions, sometimes it's just saying, here's the rule. If their accountant pushes back, I just say, hey, just email me. Bring me into the conversation. I can give them the backup. It was like Eric Oliver yesterday when he said that the accountant was like yelling at him, you better not get me thrown in jail. And he's like, gives her the law, gives her what everything says. And then she goes, oh, wait, that's really cool. And does it herself. That's, I wish I had a T-shirt or a nickel or whatever it was for every one of those, because it'd be kind of cool, because I've had that conversation on so many times where the accountant says, really, really? You can do that? Yes, here's the code provision. That's pretty cool. Yeah, you should be paying me something at that point. All right, so that's it for Tax Tuesday. For everybody that's out there in internet land, is there anything else, Elliot?
We have a lot of questions.
You've been answering them? Well, we're also out of time. So you're going to have to answer them. So Elliot's going to keep working away at answering them.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast, and if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.